Welcome back to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Today, we'll be discussing cyber conflict. Cyber conflict is a new and fascinating arena in 21st century conflict. Cyber threats faced by countries today are dramatically different from those faced just 20 years ago. On the podcast today, we'll give listeners an overview of this emerging field and help them better understand the complexities and importance of cyber conflict. Today, we'll be joined by Dr. James Carafano. Dr. James Carafano is the Vice President for Foreign Policy and National Security at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. A retired Army officer, he is a prolific writer, teacher, and commentator on world and security affairs. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Carafano.
Sure, guys, great to be with you.
All right, well, I guess we'll start off with, today we're talking about cyber and cyber conflict. So could you just give us a basic overview? What are some threats posed? Well, I guess, why don't we start even more basic? What's a cyber attack?
Yeah, well, that's a great question because there is no specific definition. It includes basically any kind of malicious cyber activity. That could be from the very lowest level, like individually, somebody has hacked your account and they went in and they drained out your debit card and emptied out your bank account, which, oh, by the way, don't put all your money in your debit card. And in your checking account, make sure you put money in your savings account because your money that's taken out of your checking account, that's lost. But anything you charge on a credit card or you have in your savings account, that's more protected. So don't be stupid. So it's everything from individually what could be a very bad day for you and when you're a college student, it doesn't take much, to either non-state actors or state actors doing malicious cyber activity. And that runs the gamut from things like stealing a whole bunch of information, as the Chinese did when they hacked into the government's Office of Personnel Management database and basically stole all the personal files, including mine, or contemplating, you know, something unthinkable, which is if China one day wanted to recover Taiwan by force, the first thing they would do is an indiscriminate cyber attack, basically taking out all the infrastructure in Taiwan instantaneously, which would not only be devastating to China, to Taiwan, but would ripple across the planet. So basically everything that's done online. Here's what I think what we get wrong when we talk about malicious cyber activity. In the end, malicious activity is malicious activity, right? Don't focus on the cyber aspect necessarily. If you want to understand it and how to counter it or protect yourself against it or mitigate it, focus on the actor. Because essentially it all comes back to a human being. Whether somebody is scamming you by calling you on the phone and saying, you got to give me a bunch of money or I'm going to take you to court, or whether they're hacking your account, it's the malicious actor you're dealing with. So sometimes I'm concerned when we talk about cyber activity, we tend to focus on you know dots and dashes and we miss, if we want to mitigate it, deal with it, solve it, we need to focus on who's doing it and what their motivations and actions are.
Well, in terms of who's doing it, thank you for the answer. Cyber attacks can be anything from stealing your bank account to destroying Taiwan.
Glad we nailed that one down, yeah.
Yeah, so in terms of the actors, I mean, what do you think is the biggest threat right now in terms of, like, large-scale cyber attacks? Are those non-state actors or are these state entities?
You know, it's difficult to really answer that question because it is very much a dynamic, nonlinear environment. So a nonlinear system is when we don't understand what the inputs and outputs, how they affect the system overall. And so, for example, you could have a individual do something and have a global ripple that you never anticipated. You know, a good example of that is it's not an individual, but a government. So the U.S. did a cyber attack on Iran, it's called Stuxnet. So essentially, we did it in coordination with the Israelis, where we were targeting the data control systems of the Iranian centrifuges that were spinning their nuclear material. But because we essentially attacked what was a common data control system, that malware actually proliferated globally, something nobody anticipated, right?
That's how we found about it.
Yeah, but you know, without question, you know, who is the 800-pound panda when it comes to malicious cyber activity? It's the Chinese, in terms of gross capability, in terms of the number of people and resources that they can throw at it, the Chinese are literally a global superpower. The Russians are very sophisticated, very capable, and also have a very kind of powerful blend of state and criminal organizations that they merge together. North Koreans have a very strong niche capability, as do the Iranians. So all the and you know, even non-state actors like, you know, Islamist terrorists, for example, have significant capabilities on in social networking, also have some interesting, unique operational capabilities. So if you think about the big bad guy list of, you know, which is interesting, Trump, Obama, and Bush all had the same bad guy list, right? Three presidents, very different, two different political parties. But when they focused on the core challenges of national security, they always talked about Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and transnational Islamist terrorism. All of them represent significant threats in the cyber world. And interestingly enough, you know, we also have to watch out for some of our friends sometimes too, because some of them have some very significant cyber capabilities, like the Israelis, for example. And they don't, while they're allies and friends, you know, sometimes they have agendas of their own too. So,
right. So, given these threats, what do you see cyber conflict, the role of cyber conflict playing in future wars and in conflicts of the near future?
Right. So I always think it's a mistake to, again, kind of compartmentalize cyber conflict as a particular thing. I think cyber challenges express themselves, particularly in conflict scenarios with state actors, as part of a spectrum of activity. So you think of D-Day, it's not just about landing troops on the shore. There's an air campaign, there's an anti-submarine campaign, there's a sea campaign, there's introduction, there's special operations. That's D-Day. It's not the guy jumping out of the back of the or the front of the landing craft. So a cyber attack by a malicious actor is likely to be part of a sequence or a series or a conglomerate of activities and campaign activities. And I think you have to look at it in that context. I think that's really key.
And do you think, I don't know, do you think like cyber abilities in, like, would a country that, say, has a lot of strong conventional you know, military strength put up against a country with maybe subpar conventional but really strong cyber strength? I mean, what's that matchup look like? Deadliest warrior.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, all competitions are unique, and competitors, particularly when they have an asymmetry of power, so if you have a very strong actor competing against a limited actor, the limited actor would say, well, asymmetrically, what can I do to challenge this guy? So if you think, for example, the Vietnam War, where we had very strong military capacity, North Vietnamese relied a lot on guerrillas and, you know, insurgent warfare and disinformation and propaganda to try to offset the U.S. capability and advantage. So you would expect an actor with more limited capabilities across the elements of national power, economic, political, to rely more on cyber as part of their either a deterrent or their or war fighting or capability across that spectrum. Good example is North Korea. I mean, there's an enormous asymmetry between the United States, Japan, and South Korea, and both in both conventional and nuclear deterrence, and what North Korea has. North Korea has probably got a larger military, but it is very antiquated, has very poor logistics. It doesn't have the capacity to fight long wars. They have a very limited nuclear capability. So one of the things they've done is built out their cyber capability, right, to kind of have another arrow in the quiver. So that's something you'd expect.
So we've talked a little bit about, like, the attacks themselves, but I'm curious, like, what can nations do to prepare for or to prevent these attacks? Like, what's the defensive strategy?
That's a great question. They sent all the really smart people here, didn't they? That is so cool. One of the big, I think, mistakes we make when we talk about cyber competition is we think in a linear manner. Like, it's our electrons versus their electrons. So if somebody's doing a cyber attack on you, then you're like, well, what kind of firewall can I put up, or, you know, change my password? Not that those things on an individual level aren't useful and important, but go back to my original comment, which is you're not competing against the electron, right? You're competing against the person. So the first question you have to ask is, what will affect the behavior of that person, right? The answer might be, I'll do a drone attack on the terrorist and I will blow him up. Therefore, any access he had to the internet then becomes kind of negligible. You might find the owner of a server that is facilitating malicious activity, and you might say, you know what? You know that property you owned in London and Miami? Well, guess what? We've just seized that. And you know, you might want to think about the activity that your company is doing, right? So I think you need, again, I think focus on the actor, their behavior, their motivation, their strengths and weaknesses and activities, and then decide what's the most efficacious and effective tool that I have to deal with that. Sometimes it's very simple at the personal level, which, you know, we have enormous amount of theft and malicious activity at the individual level, everything from, you know, sexual exploitation online to, you know, stealing your money and everything else. At the end, there is so much you as an individual can do to deal with that simply by doing what's called cyber hygiene, right? Like being smart online, like changing your password, not having a common password, not having your password be 123456789. Right. Links. What it says, my favorite one is what it says, the reminder question is, it says, you know, if you forget your password, we have these security questions. Where were you born? And like you type, where were you born?
I was born in Los Angeles.
Okay, Los Angeles, right? Like, well, the dumbest thing to do is put in Los Angeles, because if a cyber actor really wants to get into your account, do you think it's really hard for them to figure out? They could probably Google and figure out where you were born. So the answer to the security question shouldn't be the obvious things that somebody can find online. Managing what kind of activity on your privacy, on your social networks. These are all things that are super common, super easy to Google and get a list of what they are. And for you as an individual, it'll take 80% of the bad stuff off the table. And look, and increasingly, what's for a college student, what is really important is your social presence online has essentially become your fingerprint. That employers and people they're going to look at that, and that essentially becomes you. And you may or may not get a job because of your social activity and your social presence. And in terms of your reputational value, what's said and done about you online is literally as important as your criminal arrest record, which I hope is not long and extensive. No. I don't know about this guy over here, but you guys look okay, though.
Not even a parking lot. Okay, that's... Well, actually, Franz, you want to ask the next question?
Absolutely. So what role do central governments have in preventing or responding to large-scale cyber attacks within their borders?
Like, for example, I don't know. I mean, we've seen, at least there's been, like, alleged state-sponsored cyber attacks on the United States. I mean, most obviously is Russian information, disinformation, 2016, but also, if I remember correctly...
The Sony attack as well.
The Sony attacks
by
Iran,
the North Koreans, right?
Stock Exchange.
Yep, yep.
So what role does the government have in responding to this?
I think, a really great question. If you read the preamble of the Constitution, you know, it defines the role of government, which essentially is to promote our individual welfare, our security, our well-beings, right? You know, we are a sovereign nation. Sovereignty is owned by the people. We create the government for the sole purpose of protecting the community that we have. And in a sense, that protection, if it's overweening or incorrect, can actually work to the detriment of the freedoms of the community. So it's why the Constitution says, you know, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. And it doesn't say, you know, this is the first important one.
Right.
Like, this is second, this is third. It makes them all a priority, and which is interesting because oftentimes those things could be in conflict. Something that we might do to security might undermine your capacity to do free enterprise, or might impinge on your individual liberty. And the Constitution doesn't give them priority because it wants you to try to maximize all of them. And so essentially, not just in cyber activity, but in virtually every field of endeavor in which the government is involved, you know, government's job is to help keep us free, safe, and prosperous, right? And to try to do all those things in equal measure. And so my number one answer is you need to do an assessment to make sure, are we doing what we can to maximize all three, right? And so we can't just provide more security at the expense of taking away the internet and cyber activity as an engine of economic growth. We cannot unleash an engine of economic growth and leave children vulnerable online to sexual predators, right? We cannot say, well, we can have the speech on online that we like, but we should bar the speech that we don't like, right? So it needs to be a public square of free expression. So government's role is to really be efficacious in managing all three of those. And it is very, very difficult. And it gets to the core problem, which is actually government's not very good at this. And the reason for that is because if you think about it, government is really, you know, traditionally it's like, well, we're there to solve problems, right? Give me a problem. You know, you don't have healthcare. Here's a solution, right? Congress, you know, we have a problem. We'll write a law, right? The government, got a problem. We'll write a regulation or we'll attack something, right? Cyber is not so much a problem to be solved as it is an environment that we live in, right? So there's a reason why we don't have a federal department which tries to manage the weather, right? The weather, the weather's going to be the weather, and it's changing, and our job is to mitigate it. So we have FEMA, and we try to do things on climate change and everything else, but it's an environment that we live in. Cyber is an environment that we live in. The problems are constantly changing. You could be perfectly safe today, but tomorrow somebody can come up with a virus to breach your firewall. You can have a technology a week from now that didn't exist today that transforms everything. So there isn't kind of a linear answer to that. It's about operating in this very dynamic, nonlinear environment and really being attuned to those requirements. Really challenging for government because that's not what, you know, kind of what government does. And you can't do the glib answer with, oh, just let the private sector do it. Well, the private sector might get things way right, but it also could get things way wrong. So probably saw this movie, Ford Ferrari. Awesome movie. Everybody should see it, right?
I just saw the trailer yesterday.
Yeah, it's a great movie. You know, it's about the Ford company decides to get into the car racing business, and they beat Ferrari, right? And so the reason why they did it was they wanted to develop a sports car, the Mustang, the GT40, and because they didn't have any market share in sports cars and no government interference, they did that and they kicked butt, right? Now, what they don't tell you in the movie is they totally lost the ball on the small car market, which the Japanese came in with Toyota and just killed it, right? And so Ford got crushed, right? Mm-hmm. Well, so the private sector got one thing really right. You know, they cracked the sports car market, but they got the small car market like 100,000% wrong. That's okay. That's a company. They get to live and die in their own things. But when it comes to the general welfare, right, you can't just turn that over to the private sector and say, hey, if you get everything right, great. If you screw it up, we all die, no problem, you know. So there is this kind of public-private balance that has to be maintained. The private sector should do the things the private sector does, and, you know, government has to do its job, and they have to respect each other, understand each other. But they really can't supplant each other.
What about like critical infrastructure? What about like, I don't know, electric grids or?
Sure. Well, as you guys know, right, virtually what we call critical infrastructure, electrical grid, highways, railroads, hospitals. Yeah, most of that stuff is not owned by the government. So, you know, there was this, you know, like 85% of the infrastructure is in the private sector. I have no idea who made that number up. I have no idea if it's real. It's one of these things that, you know, mythology. But everybody agrees, you know what, it's just as good a number as anything else. So the government doesn't own most of the stuff. It's mostly owned by the private sector, utilities, state governments, local governments, you know, foreign governments, right? Just not us, right? On the one hand, you've got the bigger than a bread box problem, which is there is so much infrastructure out there and it's so big. It's like going after all that. That's hard. Like, even if you wanted to take down the grid, I mean, really? And the flip side of that is, you're China. Not you, personally, but China decides they wake up morning, we're going to take down the American electrical grid. Awesome. Good for you, China. You've just taken your single largest trading partner and purchaser of your goods and services offline. That's going to be really cool for the Chinese economy, right? Like, I don't think so, right? So there is a kind of, there is a mutual assured destruction here, right? Okay. That, you know, so for example, China owns a lot of U.S. debt. If the United States economy collapses, they default on all that. China's biggest source of direct, cash coming in is investing in U.S. companies and markets. If they collapse, then all that money vanishes. I mean, that's the real money China's living on is investing in the U.S. stock market. So there is a bit of mutual assured destruction there, and there's a bit of it's so big and complex from a threat perspective. Do you really understand and know what you could do that would impact that? And when you're an adversarial actor, I mean, there are different kinds. The Russians, for example, tend to be very have a high tolerance for risk, right? They'll do a lot of crap. And if it works, yeah. If it works, great. If it doesn't work, fine. Whatever, right? We just do it. It's cheap. It's easy. On the other hand, if you're, say, Al-Qaeda for something, and you have a very limited capacity to do something, you don't want to do something unless you know you're absolutely going to get it right. Or if you're somebody like China and you're doing something really big, right, you want to be really confident of what the costs and benefits of that are. So it people make the cyber competition sound like a free lunch, and it's not
really for any of the competitors.
So, how can cyber attacks, for example, be used by governments as a form of diplomatic retaliation? You know, short of traditional military conflict and sanctions.
Yeah, we just did that. I mean, if you think of the just a while back, we had a confrontation in the Gulf where the Iranian government shot down a U.S. drone that essentially was monitoring the Gulf because the Iranians were threatening to cut the shipping through the Straits of Hormuz. The Straits of Hormuz is one of the most crucial lines of communication for moving oil in and out of the Middle East. So it's really important to the global economy. So the U.S. came in, tried to stabilize the situation by having forces there, increase their situational awareness. They put up drones. The Iranians shot a drone down, right? So a lot of people said, "Oh my God, we should kill something," right? You know, and the U.S. didn't. Instead, what the U.S. did is it responded asymmetrically. Well, there was a debate about that, but what we did was smart. It was because we responded in a way in which the Iranians really couldn't counter. So we did two things. One was had nothing to do with cyber, except gathering the information, know what they were doing. The Iranians had a surreptitious pipeline that they were moving oil through Gibraltar to Syria. We got the British to shut that down, so that was a big blow. The other is we know this because the U.S. government admitted it, we did some discreet cyber attacks on Iranian air defense and other command and control systems, just reminding them, it's like, dude, if we wanted to shut you down and make you completely vulnerable for us to attack you, we could do that. And it's very clear the Iranians got the message because they didn't stop doing other things, but they stopped doing that stuff.
So it sounds like kind of what you're saying is that cyber attacks in a way are almost more effective when they're more specific.
It's all about context, right? It's all about it's part of a competition. And so you focus on the competitor and what you're doing to affect the behavior of the other side, right? So, you know, for example, when the United States indicts, you know, 12 Russian actors for malicious cyber activity, that has like zero impact, right? We're never going to arrest those guys. We're never going to bring the United States. They're completely immune. All we've really done is demonstrate, like, we know who you are, dude. Yeah. So, again, you have to look at the competitors, look at what their goals are, look at what their means of competing are, what their intent is, and then figure out how does cyber fit into that competition. And it could be different in every single situation.
That's really interesting. Really interesting. I think, I don't know, cyber's just always been something that, I don't know why, but every time I think about international relations, I think about it in, like, you know, how does cyber affect this part of this relationship or whatever? So,
yeah, like I said, oftentimes I think people get that backwards. You know, they don't start with the competitors, they start with the technology. And I think you have to study the way around. And the other thing I often emphasize is, if you really want to talk about, well, how is AI going to change diplomacy, affect the impact of military force, what will quantum computing do to encryption? well, you know, it's like, know what the hell you're talking about, right? There's so much glib talk about technology and kind of untested assumptions and really lack of knowledge and understanding. And, you know, I think people think, well, I have an iPhone. I could talk about technology. I have apps, right? And so I Googled quantum computing. So I'm not saying every American citizen should Google quantum computing, but if you want to be a serious player in a thoughtful part of the discussion, then you have to at least have a modicum of education, of understanding about what these technologies are and what they really can and cannot do. I've often, one of my greatest frustrations is when I talk to senior military officers, because, you know, I came from a military background before I went to a think tank, and you know, I'd work with senior officers, and we constantly be pressing them about how's technology going to impact the future? How's technology going to impact the future? And most of these guys were general officers who'd never spent 5 minutes thinking about this stuff. And when you talk to them, it's very, very clear that what they were doing was kind of reflecting the science fiction that they read in high school or the movie or what they saw in the last Star Wars movie, right? It was a very shallow understanding of technology. We got to do that. Do not get your science from science fiction. Right? I mean, the science in science fiction is designed to move the plot along, right? The guys beamed down on Star Trek because they didn't have the money to fly down to the planet. It was just easier to do it that way. So, I mean, you know, science fiction is entertaining. It's not real science. If you think, for example, Asimov's three laws of robotics, right?
Yeah.
Okay, this is going way back. But if you actually look at Asimov's three laws, people say, oh, my God, we can use that for AI. They're stupid. The laws make no logical sense. They're there to drive the narrative plot of the book. They're not there to be, like, a guide to science. So I would really press people, if you really want to think, you have to get your head in the game. You know, like, you can sit there and watch a football game and pontificate, but if you really want to, you know, you have to, like, understand the players and all this other stuff. There's a difference between, you know, when you and I sit there and watch, you know, Hopkins play lacrosse, right, between the guys going, yeah, you know, and people who actually understand what the hell's going on the field. I mean, me too. Yeah, yeah, totally me too. It's just a bunch of guys or girls running around with sticks.
Fulfilling some kind of primal impulse, I think.
Well, so I guess my question is, do you think that when we talk about, I mean, there has been a lot of chatter about AI, quantum computing. Franz and I just wrote recently a very long research paper about 5G. Do you think these things are being, is this threat inflation that's happening here? Or do you think it's just a lack of nuance sometimes?
No, I mean, I would say, it's AI and quantum computing are game changers. You know, not in the sense of we know what the game's going to change into, right? It's because we don't even know yet what these things are really capable of and the kind of goods and services are really going to deliver. That's actually not unusual. Almost every new technology that we've ever created winds up being something different than what we envisioned it. So even nuclear weapons, for example, you know, when we detonate a nuclear weapon, we thought, okay, this is how it's going to impact future warfare. And almost everything we thought was wrong. Oftentimes when we develop a technology, it's a better this, right? So a nuclear weapon, when it was developed, was just a bigger, better bomb, right? Email, when it was developed, was just an electronic letter. The World Wide Web was just an electronic billboard, right? Cell phones were just better phones, right? They turned out to be none of those things, right? So there's no question that, and I think if you're a college student today, you haven't really grown up with transformative technological change. You've grown up with a technological evolution, right? If you're a little older, one of the benefits of that is you've actually lived through
the time where there was
technology. Yeah,
and wasn't.
Right. So I started college with a typewriter and no calculator, right? And I finished my PhD using, German apps to do real-time translation, right? And so I've seen at least three eras of relatively significant technological change. You're going to see that in your lifetime. AI and quantum are going to... You will look at your grandkids and explain to them, and they will look back at you and they'll go, I can't believe you lived in a world like that, right? We're really? Like, people actually, what did you call them again? Cars? Like, and you drove them yourself? Like, what's the difference between that and the horse with the carriage thing? I don't understand, you know. I think it'll be that dramatic in your lifetimes.
So you talked about individual cyber hygiene earlier. Yep. So what's the equivalent for nations? What's the cyber hygiene equivalent for countries?
Yeah, the number, that's a great, yeah, well, close. The number one thing is situational awareness, right? Knowing what's going on online, right? Who the actors are and what they were doing. So that is, I would, without question, the number one thing that from a government perspective is understanding what's going on out there. That is
absolute job one.
Okay.
Do you think there's something kind of like strategically different about dealing with a state cyber actor versus like a non-state cyber actor? Or do you think that like with regards to just understanding the situation, that's you kind of take them as one and the same if they have the same capability?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. You know, everybody's a competitor, right? So, yeah, you deal with them differently. I mean, there are different legal structures for dealing with states and non-states. Non-states have much more capabilities. They also have much more vulnerabilities in terms of the ways you can reach out, touch, and influence them. So, yeah, I think the first thing, and I go back to my situation awareness thing, the first thing you have to know is who you're competing against, right? And then you look at the toolkit to figure out what's going on there. There was this kind of mythology about attribution. So if you talk to cyber experts, I'm doing air quotes here, right? Because there are so many cyber experts. Just like, you know, like a month ago, we had all these Syria experts. It was like, oh my God, who knew? But they'll say, well, the big problem is attribution. Like, you see malicious activity online, you don't know who's doing that. That's largely mythology. I mean, there are lots of things that aren't attributed. That's because you don't want to spend the time and money investing in finding out who's doing it, because it's just too easy to block them, right? If you really want to find out who's doing something, there are ways to do that. And they're not always online. Sometimes there are other forms of intelligence and things that you would gather. So we can figure out, attribution is a solvable problem to figure out who is doing this and what they're doing. But you have to have that kind of capacity and capability, because then you have to figure out how to deal with that actor. So recently, for example, you know, we had a really terrible cartel act in Mexico. A bunch of American citizens were killed. Right. And people immediately came out and said, well, we should designate the cartel as a foreign terrorist organization, which then didn't happen. And for the very good reason that FTO, foreign terrorist organization designation, really doesn't enable you to better fight cartels, which are a different animal. And it's much more, it's a different toolkit that you use largely. And so it's a great example about, you know, somebody bringing a knife to a gunfight, or, you know, picking out the hammer when you need a screwdriver. So it does all go back to having that situation awareness so that you can then look at, you know, where is the toolkit, right? Where in the toolkit do I go? And that's what you really look back to leaders and thinkers. I mean, if there's one thing I've tried to really stress in this is, we need more scientists, obviously, but it's the quality of the competitor, right? And so what's going to make, in the end, make the U.S. a successful competitor in cyberspace is we think about this in a rational, critical, informed, smart way. And the people that do that, they're the most valuable people. I spent a lot of time at Facebook and Microsoft and these other places and everything else. The people that they always say, oh, the programmers, you know, the people that they value most are not the people that can, it's the people that can think. And you don't hear about that because you don't have to pay, you know, it's like you only have to buy one of those purses, right? You know, you don't have to buy 100,000 of them, right? But it's that interface between the environment and the technical piece that's really most valuable. I mean, you know, Gates and Steve Jobs, they weren't the most brilliant technical guys ever, but they lived at that junction between the technology and the environment, and they figured out how to manipulate it better than anybody. I mean, we can all go back and say, who are the, you know, the founders of the internet? And I know all those, you know, I know all those guys, but some of those guys and everything else, they don't own Microsoft, right? And why is that? It's because they might have been technical geniuses. Or they might have been, you know, really good salesmen, but they didn't live with that one foot in that one bridge. Like, you know, Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs, totally worth reading, really understanding that kind of unique set of attributes that make a true, true technology strategic leader.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Is there anything that you think, just to wrap us up, is there anything you think that we're missing about the conversation? Like anything our listeners need to know about cyber?
Like a lot of things, if this becomes a Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Conservative, Liberal, you know, then that's wrong.
Issue.
Yeah, it's a technology. It's a competition. It's not it's not a partisan political process. And, you know, one of the issues that we work on a great deal, for example, is missile defense, and which is one where you probably say, well, you know, Republicans and conservatives love missile defense and liberals and Democrats are more skeptical. It's like, why does that make sense? I mean, missile defense is not, you know, even
values.
Right. Yeah. So I think, and I'm not saying make it nonpartisan or bipartisan. I think it's always stupid when you're going to say, well, we're going to take the politics out of life. Well, it's like, you know, it's like taking the calories out of food. But what you do need, I think in the technical space, you have to focus on the competition, the technology, the impact on people. And then you can look at, well, how do we deal with the politics of all this? But if you start with your politics, because they're for it, we're against it. Or, you know, because I'm a libertarian and, you know, we don't like government, right? Then there's no role for government. Or conversely, you know, then I think you can't start with the answer, right? You have to start with the defining the problem, understanding the problem, looking at the solutions, and then go to the answer. You can't say, well, this is what I want. How can I manipulate the problem to make it faster? My favorite one was once with an Army general, and he was describing this program that they were doing, and the chairman of our board, who's a prize-winning physicist, looked at me and said, you know, I've just been sketching on the back of a napkin here what you've described, and it defies the law of physics. And the general looked at him and said, is that a problem?
Well, all right, Dr. Carafano, it was great talking to you today.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Remember to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @Hopfa, and we'll see you next time.